Genesis 25. I hope this isn't a bore to you, and I hope you see the spiritual applications of the birthright of this country. And so I'm going to give you some. Brother Garcia is passing out some documents so you could read it with me to show the foundation of this country. A lot of times when you talk about the nations of other of the foundations of other countries, you would be getting away from the Bible. But when you're dealing with the foundation of our country, you're actually dealing with the Bible. And remember that the Bible, the vast majority of the Bible covers government structures. Obviously, that would be Old Testament. So I want to give you a little background of some things that I understand and have put together of the foundation of this country. This would just be a starting point. And the reason why I'm giving them to you so you can read it, because if I just sat up here and read it, it'd really be a drag. This is so you could follow along in the thinking. Okay, this will be what I'll call the birthright of America. In Genesis chapter 25 is the story about Esau selling his birthright out. This was a direct sellout of his birthright, being the firstborn son. And you'll see it in Genesis 25, verse 31. Okay, Genesis 25, verse 29 says, "And Jacob sowed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. Esau said to Jacob, 'Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint.' Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, 'Sell me this day thy birthright,'" right of birth. The rights that you get because you're born, okay, the birthright. "And Esau said, 'Behold, I am at the point to die, then what profit shall this birthright do me?'" Okay, so he voluntarily gave up his birthright. I don't believe Americans have done that. I believe that they have been deceived in this matter. Okay, and so hopefully we can work on some things here this afternoon. We'll pray for alertness so we don't go to sleep on this. Okay, so let's pray. Lord, thank you for your goodness, for your blessings. Lord, do ask and pray that you'd help us to understand the history of this country, where in the Old Testament you chose Israel, but in the New Testament, this nation chose you, chose thee. And Lord, I do pray you'd help us to understand what's happened and the subtlety and how the serpent has subtly come in and has created a counterfeit that looks like the real thing, and help us to recognize that. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, if you would go to Romans 13, this is a famous place as far as government structures in the New Testament. Jan and I was able to go to Des Moines, Iowa this past week. We was helping Ron Paul campaign, and there's a young fella that I got talking to. Is a Baptist kid from Texas. And he said to me, he said, "My friend is just a, man, he's just so Bush supporter." And he says, "We're supposed to obey all governing authorities because the Bible says so." And I said, "The Bible don't say that. It says that we are to be, in Romans 13, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers." He said, "Well, I know. He told me that verse." And so I said, that one place where it says that let everybody obey the governing authorities. He said, "Yeah, that's the one. I said, "Oh, that's a fake Bible. That's the translation of the New Bibles of Romans 13:1. And I quickly started to explain it to this young fella, and he said, hold. And he whipped out his cell phone. You know, these cell phones nowadays, they got everything in them things but the kitchen sink. And so he whips it out, tape records, and he starts tape recording me. And so I gave several examples in the Bible where the Bible doesn't say to anybody that you are blindly to follow any human authority. I mentioned the midwives. They disobeyed their powers that be and obeyed the highest power. I mentioned Moses' parents. I mentioned Mordecai and Haman. I mentioned the three Hebrew children. I mentioned Daniel. And the New Testament, I mentioned Peter in Acts chapter 5, where he says we ought to obey God rather than men. And so I hit them real quick. Did about a two-minute spiel, and he's great. And so he hit the thing. I'm going to show that to my friend. He said, oh, I wish I could do that. And how long did it take you to study? And so he started asking questions. So I don't know if this is... I'm praying. I got his email address. I'm going to write him back and forth. Hopefully he keeps up with it. But it was a real blessing. Now, if you know American history, you go back and think about American history. What were the churches like in the 1760s and 70s? Is it not true that we had a spiritual awakening in that time period? You had George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards, and you had John Wesley. Okay, this is a question I had for many years. Okay, if these people were having great revivals in the churches, the Bible does not teach people to outright rebel against the established authority. Okay, not outright rebel against them. Okay, when it doesn't conflict with the higher powers. So I was thinking, okay, at that time they were subjects to the King of England, how could they rebel against the king and not be wrong with God? Well, you don't learn in any of the history classes about one unique document that will help you understand that. Okay, and I didn't learn about it. Actually, I first learned about this through a book that was published by Bob Jones University. Now, I don't know if they still promote it, but this is where I first learned about it. And a week ago Saturday, I was coming back from Gene's funeral, and a couple guys sitting in the back seat, and one guy was talking about America, how we rebelled against the king. And I told him about this document. Of course, it was like I was talking to a wall, where he didn't want to accept that. But the document's called a Prohibitory Act, if I'm pronouncing it right. And I'll give you some of the documentation of that. Romans 13:1 says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Of course, that verse is messed around with all the new Bibles. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. Try that in a court today. Do the right thing, and you're not going to have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. Well, in the courts today, be afraid if you do that which is right. Try to obey the rules. For he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all dues, tribute to whom tribute, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Okay, and then so forth. Okay, now, generally, the teaching is of the guys who don't want to obey the government is that when a government does the wrong thing, that means that we can not obey them. But is that not, if the government does wrong, that means we can do wrong. Two wrongs don't make a right. Okay, so there's got to be a solution in this thing that's scriptural. Okay, and Romans 13, verse 1, obviously it lays out for us a priority scale. Our complete and full submission and obedience is to the highest power, and that's God. When the lower power under God gives an order that is directly contrary to what God says, then we're to obey God. Some call this civil disobedience, and I talked to Gene about that, and he said that's kind of not a real good term because it's kind of hard to define. He said, I think it's better to say I'd rather obey God than man. Of course, that would be the Bible thing, Acts 5:29. Okay, and so Acts 5:29, you'd rather obey God than man. So how do we do this in this country? Okay, if you would look back in, let's try Galatians 5, verse 1. Galatians 5, verse 1. Now, I understand that Galatians 5, the liberty there is spiritual liberty. Okay, we understand that. Galatians 5, stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Now, I understand the yoke of bondage is spiritual bondage and spiritual religion, all that stuff. I understand all that. But the same applies in national liberty. Okay, where the liberty that we have been given in our country, we should use it for the glory of God. Now, some people, Galatians 5:13, it says, "For brethren, ye have been called unto liberty, only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another." Some people obviously are trying to promote the one candidate because he promotes liberty because they want to do what they want to do. Hey, fine with me. You know, it's on their head, not mine. I want to use liberty for the glory of God. Can you imagine how the missionaries over in Europe are feeling right now when the dollar compared to the euro? They have taken a major pay loss. So if America's economy would do a switch because liberty has been instituted, can you imagine how that if the dollar would go up and the others would drop because of the strength of this country, that would help missionaries more than anything, as far as financially speaking. Okay, so the same thing applies. Okay, if you would back up in Proverbs, look in Proverbs 12, 24. Now, obviously, you and I are sitting on, you know, are not the direct cause of the problem where America's at right now. And a lot of people see the problems in this country. The problems began in this country, obviously, as soon as the country began. You're going to have a conspiracy always trying to take over something. But the first tyrant, and I'll use that word, to really get the ball of wax going, to really put a nail in a coffin, was Abraham Lincoln. You know, everybody talks about Honest Abe, Honest Abe, Honest Abe. There's some good books on the market you can find there's two books, same. It's two different books, same title, called The Real Lincoln, showing that Abraham Lincoln was a tyrant. Was an admitted tyrant. The Supreme Court justice named Taney said he was a tyrant. A senator from Ohio said Abraham Lincoln was a tyrant, and he was arrested, thrown in jail, was not given the opportunity to get out of jail. 2,000 people from Ohio protested. The only reason the guy got out of jail is because those people got together and protested. And during that war, the war between the states, or the war of northern aggression, Lincoln had three wars going on at once. He had a draft riot going on in New York City. Indiana was trying to secede from a union. Southern Indiana had a bunch of people who were saying, hey, let's get out of this mess. And then he had the Southerners. So it was a mess that was going on. And a little boy, a nine-year-old boy, was arrested because he was selling newspapers, and the newspaper had some articles against Abraham Lincoln. Okay, that's the tyrant that this guy was. Okay, and then the next big guy that really got the ball of wax moving was FDR. Probably you could back up to Woody Woodrow Wilson, who was a Calvinist, the son of a Presbyterian preacher. He's the one that got us in World War I deceptively, which made us get into World War II. Okay, and then FDR is the one that really, really instituted socialism in this country. Okay, and so that was a brief overview. Now let's back up and look at it. Proverbs 12, verse 24 says, "The hand of the diligent shall bear rule, but the slothful shall be under tribute." Slothful under tribute. Americans have been lazy to study their history. Okay, now on your paper, we'll run down some things. Go to number 3 right at the beginning. Here's the subtlety of the serpent. Obviously, we know he subtly has gotten into the church, and now we got all these fake Bibles. He's done the same thing in our country. Here's a Supreme Court case, Boyd versus United States. Now, if some of you haven't taken the law class, in the parentheses, it says 116. That's the book number. If you go to the Valparaiso Law Library, and that's the book you're looking for. I can show you how to do that. And 616, the second number, is the page number. Now, that's not real hard, is it, once you learn that? If an attorney can figure it out, you can figure it out. Okay? And here's what the Supreme Court said in this case. Just one statement here. It may be that it is the obnoxious thing in its mildest and least repulsive form, but illegitimate and unconstitutional practices get their first footing in that way, namely by silent approaches and slight deviations from legal modes of procedure. In other words, it's very subtle. Very subtle. President James Madison said, "I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachment of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations." Okay, now if you look in your pocket, you've got a Federal Reserve note. It's not a dollar. It's a piece of paper with green ink on it that costs 3.5 cents to print. Somebody in the Fed decided to do it. Okay, they, you know, made it up. Now, a lot of Americans don't understand that. Amazing, people are understanding that now. Okay, they're really getting under that. But this has been a real subtle thing. If you saw the currency laid out in front of you from start to finish, you could really understand what's going on. Now, I have examples of several of the currencies. I have, you know, one back from Lincoln Day, the military script. I've got the Federal Reserve note where it said that you can redeem it for lawful money of count. I have a silver certificate. In 1960, you had three forms of currency floating around in 1960. Three different $5 bills in 1962. One was United States note, one was a Federal Reserve note, and one was a silver certificate note. Five different ones. Okay, and the last one who competed with the Fed was JFK, and of course we know what happened to him. And the first executive order LBJ did is pulled all the United States notes out of currency. Okay, but when you lay all these currencies side by side, you can see how subtly they did it. Because you can see, when they're side by side, you can see the subtle methods. Okay, now let's go to America. In number four, I have that document underlined. That's a long document that I don't have in paper form. I have it on computer. That basically is like the, what is that? Is that the notes that they took during the development of the Constitution? So that's like the notes where they showed you what the thinking of the men were when they developed this nation. Okay, and so, you know, I haven't even read the whole thing, but there's that. Okay, now let's trace it back in America. Okay, in the colonists were subjects under the king living in England. Okay, was anybody over here? We got the Indians and may have some Vikings. You may have some other people. Okay. In 1492, old Columbus, you know, he came over here and he does not have a good testimony if you really read his testimony. He came over here for gold, not Christianity. In 1620, you had the Mayflower Compact. So that would be our first document we're going to look at or discuss real briefly. And, of course, we know this is over there in Massachusetts. And if you go over to Massachusetts, there's a place over there where they have a Plymouth Colony in that reenactment. It's very interesting, very fun to go to. William Bradford's there. Okay, and these people will only operate of the knowledge of those days. You can't tell them about cars. They don't know what that is. If you tell them where you live, they'll try to, where's that? Never heard of that territory. And so it's a real fun place to go over there in Massachusetts. Okay, notice what they said on this compact agreement. In the name of God, amen, we whose names are underwritten. Notice they understood their lawful position. The loyal subjects of our dreaded sovereign Lord King James, by the grace of God, having undertaken for the glory of God an advancement of the Christian faith, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia. Obviously, I'm not citing the whole thing. I'm just doing parts of it. Notice these people understood that since the king paid their way, the king is providing the money for the colony, the king is their authority. They were loyal subjects. That's a Christian thing. Okay, the first permanent English settlement in America is called Jamestown. We know it's named after King James. In 1689, the English people were getting fed up with some of the plundering of the king, and so they begged the king, redressed the king, and what came out of that was called the English Bill of Rights. I don't have that copy here. I got it in the back of this book. And what they were doing is they were redressing their grievances to the king. What's that mean? Redress. Address. That means complain. Okay, if you raise no objection, you have no objection. So you complain to the king verbally. They were complaining about the unlawful plunder or the taxation of King George. And in October of 1774, these were the declaration and resolves of the First Continental Congress. Now you've got the 13 colonies established, and now they're getting some of their leadership together about the gripes that they have. And this took place in October of 1774, and these are some statements that they made. Now, where is our lawful authority, Bible authority, to do this? Daniel 1, verse 8. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. He redressed his grievances to Melzar, offered a deal with him, okay, and he passed a test, because if he would have blindly followed a king, he would have defiled himself and all that stuff. So there's our motive of our redress of grievances. Okay, in this document, here's some things that they said. The inhabitants of the English colonies in North America, by the immutable laws of nature, that is a very unique statement that they make. The principles of the English Constitution and several charters or compacts have the following rights. Okay, here's what we have. And of course, I'm not doing them all. I'm just doing portions of them. That our ancestors who first settled these colonies were entitled to all the rights, liberties, immunities of free and natural born, notice the word, subjects. Within the realm of England, they knew that they were subjects under the king. Okay, the letter C, that the respective colonies are entitled to the common law of England. The common law is the fourth part of law in Indiana in priority. It's fourth one that's listed in the code. The common law. Okay, then letter D, that they have a right peaceably to assemble, consider of their grievances, and petition the king. Of course, you see that one in the Constitution where we have a free right to assemble. This is a right to assemble and gripe amongst each other and say, okay, let's get our gripes together and go to the king. We have that right. Then notice the next one. Also, the act passed in the same session by establishing the Roman Catholic religion in the province of Quebec, abolishing the equitable system of English laws and erecting a tyranny there to the great danger of the neighboring British colonies. Okay, these people found out that Quebec, Canada, a law was passed up there that Roman Catholicism was the established religion. What did these people know of that time? They fled that, did they not? They fled that. Now they're afraid. Here are these Roman Catholics up here, and they're going to come after us. And so then they petitioned the king that we should have a right to bear arms. We Protestants should have a right to bear arms to defend ourselves, because they remembered the Inquisition. This was all laid out. And so when the king allowed the Catholicism to be passed up there, they figured, man, this is underhanded. He's coming after us. Well, when this took place. So, that was October of 1774. By July, they said they had another declaration and caused the necessity of taking up arms. By July of 1775, number two, they said, we need to get some guns. We need to defend ourselves. Notice it's not aggressive. It's a defense. Their motive for arms was self-defense. Okay, that's why we call the military the Department of Defense. It's been changed to offense. Okay, that was July. In August, the king said, "You people are rebelling." So he wrote this proclamation that the colonists are in rebellion. Then the colonists had to respond to that. Okay, and I'm not giving the, you know, what they're saying, but the colonists' response to the proclamation of a rebellion. Okay, and all during this time, there was a great awakening taking up place in America. All at this time. You had preachers preaching about the tyranny of King George. I mean, they were letting it fly. The Baptists and the Presbyterians, those two groups were the main groups. And it got so bad that the king called it a Presbyterian rebellion. And the number one people they wanted to kill on their hit list were the preachers of the day. They wanted to confiscate the churches for two reasons. One is that's where the libraries were. And two, that's where they stored their armament. Well, if we did that today, wouldn't that really get the talk going? Okay, that's what they did then. Now, here's where it comes in, okay, on Roman numeral 2. The Prohibitory Act comes in play January 1st, 1776. That act, okay, I just give it briefly there. By the time, remember this came in play January 1st, it was started to be developed in September of 1775. The king signed it in December of 1775. It came in force January 1st of 1776. The colonists did not hear about it until late February. This wasn't the internet days. This was slow ship coming across. They figured it out. They got a copy of it in late February or middle February. And here's what John Adams wrote. This is a portion of his letter. And he wrote, "I know not whether you have seen the act of Parliament called the Restraining Act or Prohibitory Act or Piratical Act or Plundering Act or Act of Independency. For by all of these titles is it called, I think, the most opposite to the Act of Independency. For King, Lords, and Commons have united in sundering this country from that, I think, forever. It is a complete dismemberment of the British Empire. It throws 13 colonies out of the royal protection, levels all distinctions, and makes us independent in spite of our supplications and entreaties." If you read some of the letters prior to this and all the time that they were petitioning the king, they would kept saying, "We loyal subjects, we loyal subjects, we want to be loyal to the king, our loyal subjects." And so they were petitioning the king verbally, and now this act comes out. And they understood that what the king did is the king threw them off. He is no longer their king. He is no longer their protector. They did not rebel against the king and threw themselves off. He voluntarily threw them off. That's what they understood. Most of these people had John Blackstone's commentaries, and they knew what happened. The king threw them off. They are now without a king. Okay? That was their understanding. In May 6, 1776, a memorable convention was met at Williamsburg, Virginia. Now, have anybody been down to Williamsburg besides my family? You have? Anybody else been to Williamsburg, Virginia? Great place to go. Again, it's pricey, okay, but man, it's a great place, a lot of fun. Last time we were there, Patrick Henry was there, okay, obviously an actor, okay, and I heard him give a speech. And he was giving a speech, and he got all these Americans there, and he said, "Now, I must apologize to you ladies, because you neither care nor have the mindset for politics." You know, of course, everybody's kind of chuckling about it. But, of course, that's what they thought. And then he talked about his wife. She went insane, and how he had to deal with that and all that stuff. Patrick Henry was what was known as an anti-federalist. You had one side of faction, the Federalists, and Alexander Hamilton was one of those where he more wanted to push on a federal government, and Patrick Henry is an anti-federalist going against it. Okay, that's the camp I would have been in, you know, personally. But Patrick Henry, there was a letter found, a handwritten letter, and the handwriting appeared to be Patrick Henry's, and here's what he wrote during this convention. As the humble petitions of the Continental Congress have been rejected and treated with contempt, as the Parliament of Great Britain, so far from showing any disposition to redress our grievances, have lately passed an act approving of the ravages that have been committed upon our coast, and as the King of Great Britain, by a long series of oppressive acts, have proved himself the tyrant instead of the protector of this people, we, the representatives of the colony of Virginia, do declare that we hold ourselves absolved of our allegiance to the crown of Great Britain, and obliged by the eternal laws of self-preservation to pursue such measures as may be conduced to the good and happiness of the United Colonies, and as and for a full declaration of independence appears to us to be the only honorable means under heaven of obtaining happiness and of restoring us again to tranquil and prosperous situation. Now, he was writing that out, probably figuring out maybe they'll be using it, but these guys were so sharp, they wrote this stuff out, you know, right on the spot. Again, these guys understood that that act, the Prohibitory Act, threw them off. They did not rebel against the king when you understand this. In May 14th, less than a week or just 8 days later, after May 6th, here was a document that was a resolution that came about. It says, by a late act, that's understood to be the Prohibitory Act, all of these colonies are declared to be in rebellion and out of the protection of the British Crown. Our property is subjected to confiscation and so forth. And it talks about them losing their property and about British soldiers coming and stealing stuff and taking their ships and everything. Okay, and so this is what they understood. Therefore, you have the declaration of Thomas Jefferson. When you read the declaration with the Prohibitory Act in mind, you can read, you can understand why he said what he said or wrote what he wrote. Now, just to look at the black part, the bold portion, it says that these United Colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown. You know, I think the American Revolution was a myth. It wasn't a revolution or rebellion against the king. The king threw them off. The Declaration of Independence is declared, okay? Sovereign people in December 31st, 1775, every person in America was a subject under the king. January 1st, 1776, every person in America had no king from his act. So they were without a king up till July 3, 1776. They were without a king. They were a people without a government, per se, without a king over them. July 4th, they declared officially their independence. One of the motivations was the hoping that the French would come and help them in a war, but of course you can't rely on them, even to this day. Okay, so July 4th, they have publicly declared their sovereignty. Every able-bodied man over 20 years old on July 4th, 1776, became an equal to the King of England. He became the king of his land, every one of them. That is of the 13 colonies. Now, here come the British soldiers. What are they going to do? Self-defense. The King George hired German mercenaries to attack the American colonies. Now, what do? Self-defense. So, here they are, and their motto of that war was, of self-defense, their motto was, no king but King Jesus. Now, this took the king 7 years to admit it. Hey, when you got a major parasite at the top who gets a bunch of money from a bunch of people, he don't want to give that up. It's like a tick. You know, you got to take a hot knife and torch the rump of the tick, hopefully to get the head out. Okay, and so he finally, in the Paris Peace Treaty of 1783, where the king finally admitted that they lost, notice the wording of what he wrote. Article 1, this would be on Roman numeral 3. It says, His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States to be free, sovereign, and independent states. Each one was an individual nation, the nation of Rhode Island, the Republic of Massachusetts, the Republic of Maine. Each of them was independent nations. That he treats with them as such and for himself, his heirs and successors, relinquishes all claims to the government, propriety, and territorial rights of the same and every part thereof. Notice Article 7. He understood the lawful position of the people. There shall be a firm and perpetual peace between his Britannic Majesty and the said states and between the subjects of the one and the citizens of the other. You see the differences? The subjects of Britain and the free and sovereign citizens of these United States. He separated them. And if you look up the word citizen in Bouvier dictionaries, you'll see more about that. Article 8, it says, The navigation of the river Mississippi shall forever remain free and open to the subjects of Great Britain and the citizens of the United States. He distinguished between them. Now, if all this is true, then we could have other documentation on this. Now, the constitution of each individual states, who designed that? Who created those? If the people are the sovereigns, they had somebody draw up the constitutions of each state. The people voted that the constitution will be the job description for any public servant. That is their job description. They will read that job description. If they don't like it, then don't go for office. Back then, in Delaware, anybody who was up for election had to publicly declare and sign it that they believed in God, the sovereign God, the Lord Jesus Christ, that the scriptures were inspired of God in the Old and New Testament. Article 22 of Delaware. They actually had to sign that in agreement. That was Delaware. Pennsylvania had a little bit different version of that. Okay, and so the Constitution is a job description prior to taking office. After taking office, it is a contract that says that I will stay within these bounds. Do they do that today? They didn't even come close to it. Okay, now, further down. Letter A. The Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States. This is a Supreme Court case. The first number is the volume of the book. The middle letters, that's the United States Supreme Court. The last number, that's the page number. 1892, that's when the case took place. That will be the best case. It's 7 pages, not hard to read. I've got a copy of it if you want to read it. That it will be the shortest and quickest way to find out that this nation is a Christian foundation. They run through many of the Supreme Court cited from many state constitutions showing that, and they declared straight up, this is a Christian nation. Now that case, you say, well, that's too long, that's 1892, that's a long time ago. Okay, the next one, Public Citizen versus Department of Justice, volume 491, page 440. Now that's when the start of the case, I don't know how many pages it is, I forget this one. That case, 1989, cites the exact quote out of the 1892 case stating again that this is a Christian nation. They cite it again. Okay, that's not a Baptist preacher's opinion. That is nine. I don't know if the Supreme Court had nine justices back in 1892. That's what they got now. That is the Supreme Court justice of the United States, the highest court in this country, said in 1892. So what is the Constitution? Okay, the next one. The Constitution becomes a compact. It becomes a contract. This is a Supreme Court case. Now, this one says 2 Dallas 417. Back in those days, they had certain men putting those together. So one would be Dallas, one would be Wheaton, and there's about one is Peters, and there's different ones back then. It's still a Supreme Court case, but you can see it's very, very early. 2 Dallas 417. Here's what the Supreme Court said. Here we see the people acting as sovereigns of the whole country. The people. Not the federal government, not the state government. The people are the sovereigns. We're the top dog. Okay? And in the language of sovereignty, establishing a constitution by which was their will that the state government should be bound and to which the state constitution should be made to conform. Every state constitution is a compact made by and between the citizens of a state to govern themselves in a certain manner. And a constitution of the United States is likewise a compact made by the people of the United States to govern themselves as general objects in a certain matter. Okay, there's another Supreme Court case that follow it. 1 Wheat 324. Again, that is a very, very early case. That'll be a very old book. It is in the Valparaiso Law Library. That one said that. The people are the highest authority. And then there's a newer case. How about that one? Yiko. That's a Japanese guy who had a laundry business many years ago. And in that case, they said that the sovereignty itself is, of course, not subject to the law. Boy, can't you run with that one? You know, a speeding ticket, look at the police officer. Hey, I'm the sovereign. Sovereignty is not subject to your laws. You know, think about that one for a while. Of course, you could really distort that. You know, but put that on them. Okay? And for it is the author and source of law. And but in our system, while sovereign powers are delegated to the agencies of government, sovereignty itself remains with the people, by whom and for whom all government exists and acts, and the law is definition of limitation of power. Okay, now, but what about our state? Where were we at that time? Man, we were over flooded with Indians. Okay, and so what is the foundation document for the state of Indiana? Well, we know it's the Northwest Ordinance. If you get a copy of that, okay, you can read it. But notice I have some of the information out of the Northwest Ordinance, and you can see that we have fallen way far away from that. Okay, Article 3, it would be number 4 on the letter C. It says, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and happiness of mankind, schools and means of education shall forever be encouraged. What's that mean? That means they're supposed to teach about the Bible in the schools. That is a law under the Northwest Ordinance. The public education is required by the Northwest Ordinance to teach religion in school. That overthrows Trump's separation of church and state. As far as the state, the church can't have authority over the state. Article 4. This is going to kill her. No tax shall be imposed on lands, the property of the United States. No tax be imposed on lands, property taxes. That's illegal. But of course, how do you fight it? You know, I know Eric Miller is trying to get a thing for, I think, 2010 election that we can repeal property taxes. He's trying to do that. But this is a Northwest Ordinance. That's supposed to be the authority of this land. Okay, and then here's where it started coming in on Roman numeral 6, is the counterfeit Constitution of the United States, dishonest Abraham Lincoln, and I find it interesting, the 39th Congress. What's so interesting about that? 3 times 13. 39 stripes. 39 books in the Old Testament. The last word in the Old Testament is a curse. 39th Congress. And then if you read the Liber Code of April 24th, 1863, this gives instruction for the government of armies in the field. Martial law. That's Lincoln's brainchild. And here's the congressman, that name, look at that name, Vallandigham of Ohio, referred to Abraham Lincoln as the master dictator. He was thrown in jail for that. He was not given the right of habeas corpus to get released from jail. And Lincoln had several people in jail, would not let them out, would not try them, would not do anything. It's, you know, like we got the secret prisons, what we got now. And it's always good when a black man makes a real good quote, standing on the side of the South in that war. And this man said, an editor in Charleston, South Carolina, he said, Richard Harvey Kane said in 1871, when the smoke and the fighting is over, the Negroes have gained nothing and the whites have nothing left, while the jackals have all the booty. The jackals he's referring to is Congress. Okay, and that's who's got all the booty. And it hadn't changed. Hopefully this time around it will. By God's grace and God's mercy. The people have been alerted. They have been alerted. But I don't know if it's going to be hijacked. And so it's something we need to pray for our country. Okay, so I hope that gives you a good start. This is a birthright of this country.